Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
You're listening to Working, the podcast about what people do all day. I'm Jacob Brogan. This season on Working, we're talking about animals with jobs. And for the episode you're about to listen to, we talked about an animal job that I've always wondered about. How do service animals, specifically service dogs, work? We sat down with Al Elia, who is blind and who works every day with a 70-pound black lab named Cheech, who helps guide him through the world as he moves through it. We talked about everything from Cheech's training to the way that Al communicates with Cheech to the way that Cheech communicates with Al. Then in a Slate Plus Extra, Al, who is himself a Slate Plus member, told us how Cheech got his name and his own approach to the names of the service animals that he has worked with over the years. If you're a member, enjoy that and other great Slate Plus Extras. Start your 2-week free trial today at slate.com/workingplus. What is your animal's name and what does it do?
So this is Cheech, and he is a guide dog.
He's down here on the floor in the
He's
studio.
Laying on the floor. He may be falling asleep. That's what he often does when I'm sitting down and and not actively doing something that involves him.
So before we go any further, what is your name and what is your relationship with Cheech?
My name is Al Elia, and my relationship with Cheech is I am his handler. Mm-hmm. I am blind, so he is a service dog, and specifically he is a guide dog for the blind.
How long has Cheech been working with you in this capacity as a guide dog?
I got Cheech in October of 2014. So what are we at? About almost 4 years?
Yeah,
three and a half years?
And how did you start working with him in the first place? Or how did he start working with you? I guess it's his job. It's your life.
Well, so I should say he is my fourth service dog.
Okay.
So my experience beginning to use Cheech was a little bit different than if he was my first guide dog. Mm-hmm. You know, because he's my fourth dog, the process is a little bit shortened. But basically, there is an application process for a guide dog. You apply to a school. There are a bunch of schools. The schools that I have used have exclusively done what they call in-community training. Mm-hmm. So rather than go to the school and stay there for, you know, 2 or 3 weeks to learn to use the dog, the in-community training schools send the dog and the trainer to you and train you sort of on your schedule in your community, in an environment you're used to, which they feel is, you know, better for the dog, the handler, and just sort of generally all around.
Mm-hmm. So you've already touched on one of my other questions, which is that you've worked with multiple dogs over the years. You know, what's it been like going through different service animals over that time?
It's very difficult getting to – well, you get used – it's very difficult moving from your first dog to your second dog. You learn to use the first dog, and when you're learning with the first dog, you're both sort of learning what it's like to be paired with somebody you're not familiar with, right? The dog has been training with trainers who the dog has become familiar with. You have never worked with a dog before, so you're learning to be guided around by a dog and trust the dog. So you sort of develop a relationship, and it takes about 6 months to a year to really develop a good working relationship. Mm-hmm. You know, to sort of the way I put it is become a well-oiled machine. Mm-hmm. But you know, then you get the second dog. And of course, you're used to the well-oiled machine, and all of a sudden, it'd be kind of like if you got into a new car and you couldn't find the windshield wiper control, and you're looking all over for it, and the rain is pouring down. You're like, where is the – it's like that.
Yeah.
Only with more than just looking for one control. It's, right. you know, the way that the dog behaves.
Yeah, and I imagine – I mean, we'll talk more about what Cheech does for you or with you in a minute, but I would have to imagine that that must be really difficult period of adaptation where, you know, if you've gotten used to being supported in one way by a particular animal, then having to learn all of that again must feel pretty rough.
As I said, it's the most difficult going from your first dog to your second dog.
Yeah.
After that, you realize, okay, I've been through this before. I'm going to take a deep breath. You know, this is going to take some time.
Mm-hmm.
The process with and that is the reason why they have a period of training with a trainer. The trainer is only with you for approximately, you know, 2 weeks
mm-hmm.
for subsequent to your first dogs, about 3 weeks for your first dog, mm-hmm. maybe a month tops, depending how things go. When you are learning to use the dog with the trainer, part of what the trainer is there for is to, you know, make sure that you and the dog are working well as a team, that mm-hmm. the dog isn't stressed out by, you know, something you're doing, that your pace is well matched, et cetera, that you're not overpowering the dog and the dog is not overpowering mm-hmm. you. And then, you know, as I said, it's about another 6 months, maybe a year before you really start to, you know, become a well-oiled machine.
And you, I assume, though, are a well-oiled machine with Cheech now?
Yes. You know, we've been working together now for enough years that, you know, I know the things I need to watch out for with him.
Mm-hmm.
He knows the things he needs to watch out for with me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's sort of they deliver a dog that is trained to guide, they being the school, delivers mm-hmm. a dog that's trained to guide a generic blind person.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, you and the dog working together sort of figure out, like, okay, you know, well, for instance, I walk really fast.
Mm-hmm.
And if I am guiding, if he's guiding me toward a cross, you know, through a crosswalk, and there is an up curb or a down curb, you know, where what they commonly call wheelchair ramps, but mm-hmm. we call up curb, down curb, then, you know, I don't want him to stop unless there's, you know, unless it's a busy road and we need to stop to mm-hmm. hear for traffic. When he shows up, when he's delivered, they're trained to stop at, you know, at every step, at every curb, you know, at sort of every possible point where you might want to make a choice.
So some of it's untraining, learning to work together.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, so let's talk about what he does more generally, or what service animals like him maybe even do more generally. What are they trained to do for a generic blind person, as you put it?
So they're trained with a set of commands. So he knows his name. Then forward, left, right, find, followed by something else. So I can say find left, find right, find upstairs, find downstairs, find inside, find outside. And work it out.
Okay.
So for instance, when I got off the metro today, he's used to taking a different metro exit than the one where you guys are. He's used to going to the L Street exit that's further back on the platform, lets out the other side of L Street.
We're all the way at the end of the platform.
Exactly. And so when I knew which exit we needed to take, but, you know, we come here pretty frequently for an office that I go to, you know, a couple times a week.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I told him to go past the escalator we normally take, you know, he stopped and he tried to turn me around, you know, because it's like, you're lost. You're confused.
Yeah.
I know where we are.
Yeah.
And I had to, you know, stop, say, no, it's a good boy, forward. And he would take a couple of steps forward and then he would stop and start to turn around again. Like, no, good boy, forward, and move forward. And eventually, once he figured out that, no, I really did know where I was going and I really did want him to continue down the platform, then I said, okay, good boy. Now, find upstairs. And then he saw the escalator at the end of the platform and he started to walk faster. He was like, okay, I now know where we're going.
Does he – maybe I'm getting ahead of myself here or getting ahead of our questions here, but does he also like have to develop an understanding of things like the particulars of metro entrance and exit gates?
He will, and I believe they train them for this. He will try to go to a accessible entrance, you know, the wide one, which conveniently mostly, I think, all of the accessible entrances are two-way. But he is not able to distinguish an in-gate from an out-gate. And so, for instance, when I arrived here, he took me to the first gate that we came upon, and you know, I put my card on. It didn't open, so I stepped left, you know, stepped right. Tried that one. Nope. Step right again. And thankfully, the third one I tried was the right one.
Right. Because the trick for our listeners who are not here in Washington, D.C. is that some of the gates in the subway and the metro are one way and some are not. And the sign that tells you which way it is red or green, basically, which is I think probably not even in a dog's visual wheelhouse necessarily. So it could be a tricky thing for him. What else? So it sounds like some of what he does is provide you with directional instruction. What are the other elements of his job?
Well, so it's my job to know where I want to go. And it's my job to know generally how to get there. And it's his job to take direction from me and sort of figure out the niggling little details to make sure that, you know, I don't run into things, that I don't run into people. And if I tell him to do something that will get us killed, to not do it and, in fact, stop me. So, for example, it's my job to – when we're standing at a corner ready to cross the street, it's my job to listen for when I think it is safe for us to cross by listening for the, you know, near-side parallel traffic. And when near-side parallel traffic is going, then, you know, I tell you, okay, forward. And, you know, if he doesn't – you know, if he sees an electric car coming – and a high-speed chase, you know, down the street that we're about to cross that's going to hit us, then it's his job to sort of shoulder check me in the knee to be like, no, bad idea.
So, I mean, you're touching on something that I also wondered about, which is how does he communicate with you typically? Is it mostly physical?
It's entirely physical. I'm trying to think whether any of my – I mean, so I will say one thing about Cheech. Cheech is a black lab. He's about 75 pounds. He is extremely quiet. He will basically vocalize if we're playing tug of war and if you get him really excited about a toy, and that's about it. My previous dogs were German Shepherds, and they would bark at the drop of a hat. Now, Cheech – I don't think even the German Shepherds would communicate sort of verbally in when they were working, you know, when they were guiding. It's almost entirely physical. It is a – the dog will stop. The dog will back up. Or in extremely dangerous situations, the dog will sort of shoulder check you in the knee and move across you. So I should say Cheech is always on my left. So I'm always holding his harness with my left hand. And so he would, you know, if I'm standing at a corner and I tell him to go, and let's say I took a step forward and he saw something very dangerous, like an open manhole cover right in front of me, say, he would leap across me, you know, from my left to my right and sort of turn me and move me away from whatever the danger was.
I'm thinking here of the way my mother, well past the point where she needed to do this when we were driving, if she had to stop suddenly, would always put her arm out in front of me.
Yes, exactly.
A little like that.
Yeah.
In, you know, that merest sight of danger. I mean, how does he learn to recognize what does and doesn't count as potentially dangerous though?
Well, I mean, that's part of his training before I get him. Now, I am introduced to that training because they will – among the things that they will do is – especially for your first dog, but to some extent with subsequent dogs and when you try a new school, they will often – present you with a potentially dangerous situation. For example, go up to the edge of the subway platform when there is not a train coming, and pick up the harness and tell the dog forward when you're standing on the edge of the platform, and the dog will, you know, back up, pull you back, jump across you if necessary, you know, do all the things that say, no, this is very dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of the dog's training.
Yeah.
You know, similarly, if the dog sees a giant hole in the ground that you're stepping toward, the dog knows holes in the ground are bad. So,
is he mostly trained for and accustomed to thinking about working in urban environments? And what happens when you find yourself in a different setting with him?
He has a preference for urban environments. And I say that because one of the things that the guide schools, at least the community training schools that I have used, do when you are applying for a dog is they ask you what environment you live in and mm-hmm. you go to frequently. They then, when they're training the dogs, they train them in a bunch of different environments, in urban environments, rural environments, suburban environments, etc. And the trainers can tell which dogs prefer which environments, just like they can tell, you know, which dogs are naturally more fast-paced or slower, mm-hmm. You know, more physical, less physical. You know, I'm about 200 pounds, so, you know, and a pretty strong guy. Mm-hmm. So they typically give me, you know, a fairly strong, large male dog who is fast-paced.
Mm-hmm.
If I were, you know, a smaller, more frail person who nevertheless needed a service dog, they would pair me with a different dog who mm-hmm. did not have those traits.
Yeah.
And similarly, if I lived in the country, they would give me a dog who enjoyed walking country, what they call country walk, which is where you're basically walking along the side of the street where there's no sidewalk.
Mm-hmm.
Cheech hates that.
Can he do it though?
He will do it if required, but he moves really fast and you can tell that he's stressed out and he wants this to be over.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Can you think of any moments, like specific stories about times when he has actually stopped you from a dangerous situation, something like this?
A dangerous situation? No.
Mm-hmm.
You know, really, if he needs to get us out of a dangerous situation like that, it's because I haven't done my job.
Mm.
It's because I wasn't paying enough attention, and you know, and you know, obviously, I don't want us to get into a dangerous situation. So, I do my job,
right?
In terms of not putting us in a situation where he needs to get freaked out and stressed, and you know, and that's, you know, having to deal with the stressful situation, with the dangerous situation, while he is trained to do that, it is stressful.
Yeah.
I can tell you a story about my first guide dog where I was in Italy and I decided to go for a walk along a mountain and my dog did not want to guide me.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time I had enough vision that I thought I would be okay and I slipped off the mountain and only avoided falling to my death by holding onto the leash.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, you know, he said at the point when I pulled myself back up, he was extremely stressed out.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, I promptly let him guide me back off of the mountain to a different path.
So some of your work with the dogs is about managing their moods as well, making sure that they're comfortable. I mean, that you're safe, that they're not freaked out.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
So what's a day in the life for him? Is it really just map onto your own schedule, your own time?
Pretty much. You know, I work from... I work from home more than I work from an office now.
You're a lawyer.
I'm an attorney.
Attorney.
And I recently completed a fellowship where I was working for a firm in Baltimore. So I was having to commute out to Baltimore from D.C., you know, back and forth most days.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll tell you about a day like that because it's a little more interesting.
Sure.
I would get up in the morning. You know, I'd feed him. Mm-hmm. He eats once a day in the morning.
What does he eat? What's his...
He eats 2 cups of a food called Bench and Field that I get from Trader Joe's.
Okay.
And he eats that food because for the first couple of years I had him, he was developing ear infections.
Mm-hmm.
And so we figured out that that was the food that didn't give him ear infections.
That's
so
good to know.
Yeah. So,
so bench know, and field.
Bench and field.
In the morning.
In the morning. You know, we leave the apartment. We go to the metro. He will – once we get out of the building, I will pick up the harness and I'll say, okay, you know, Cheech, work it out. And at that point, because we do this every day, it's really autopilot from the door to my building to the metro entrance.
Hmm.
In fact, all the way through to the turnstile, we have to stop there because I have to pull out my card. But mm-hmm. at this point, Cheech is autopiloting. He says, I know where we're going. Mm-hmm. We're going to the metro. We go up the escalator to the metro and he will turn to the left to go to the Red Line platform that will take us to Union Station. And we'll get on, he will then sit and we'll wait. When the metro pulls up, he will stand up. I'll pick up the harness and he will walk over to the door and stare at the door waiting for it to open.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, because of the way that the Washington Metro often sort of discharges people, I'll sort of step to the side so mm-hmm. I'm not standing. If he had his way, we would simply step onto the train as soon as the door opened. So I'll sort of get us out of the way. And then, as soon as I can sort of stop hearing people walk out of the train, mm-hmm. I'll pick up the harness and he'll guide me onto the train. And he will look for a seat.
Mm-hmm.
So if there are people in all of the seats, he will occasionally go up and sort of, sit and stare at a person in one of the seats near the door as if to say, you're sitting in the seat that's supposed to be reserved for my person.
Mm-hmm. So he recognizes where you're supposed to be in the train.
Yes, although again, it's habit, right?
Mm-hmm.
He knows that we usually sit in one of the seats that's right by the door, and so by habit, he will look to see if there mm-hmm. is a seat, and if there isn't, he'll pick some mm-hmm. unsuspecting soul to stare at pleadingly to move.
Do they usually move?
No, not usually. Usually, I end up having to sort of check all four seats, and finally, when I get to the fourth seat, enough people will be clamoring for the person to move.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I'll just stand because it's not like I need a seat.
Right.
It's convenient for me to have a seat because I can get him out of the way.
Interesting,
right?
Yeah.
It's a similar situation when I'm boarding a plane, mm-hmm. right? If I'm boarding a plane, it's not that I need to get on the plane earlier. It's that I need to get a dog settled. And it's a lot easier for me to get the dog settled if there aren't a bunch of people all staring at him.
Mm-hmm.
Where when people stare at him, he sort of stares back and wonders, why are they staring at me?
Right.
Is there something I need to know about this person?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I should go say hi and see what's up.
Yeah.
Anyway, so we're on the subway and we take the subway to Union Station. I'm still not certain whether he's able to determine that this is Union Station where we get off.
Mm-hmm.
I've had dogs that knew where our stop was, and because Union Station is the first stop that you go from sort of above ground to underground
mm-hmm.
From where we live, he could know that that's the station. But mm-hmm. usually because I'm getting up, you never know whether he's picking up on the fact that I am sort of, picking up my bag and making like I'm ready to get off the train or mm-hmm. if he's actually recognizing that we need to get off the train.
Mm-hmm.
We get off the train. I pick up the harness again and I say, okay, find the way or work it out
mm-hmm.
Or find upstairs. Again, because we go to Union Station a lot, he will go to the particular escalators that lead up to near where the platforms are that have the trains that go to Baltimore, the mm-hmm. MARC train platforms. He will go, he'll guide me up the escalator to the accessible turnstile, around to the other escalator, up, and then through to the train waiting area.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, he'll stop and, because at that point he knows that I ask the person behind the desk, where's the next train to Camden Station?
Yeah.
I find out because I've been going there enough. When we need to go to a platform, he doesn't know where the platform is.
Sure.
Right? So I can't say find platform 7. That would be great, but So if they say platform 7, it's my job to know where it is, mm-hmm. tell him to go. If he starts to turn too much, I'll notice, for example, that there's a up ramp leading to, you know, the platform. And I know that platform 7 is one of the low platforms. So I know we've turned too early. I was like, good mm-hmm. boy. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, you never want to sort of correct him without praising for something that he's done mm-hmm. that could be correct, but in this case isn't. Mm-hmm. So, you know, find the way. Okay, this is a way, not the right way. Good boy. Try again. Similar thing when I was trying to get into the building here. I didn't know exactly where 1707 was. Mm-hmm. And so I went into the sandwich shop, and then I went into the smoothie shop, and then I went in here. Mm-hmm. And each time it's like, good boy, okay, all right, left, now find inside.
Interesting, yeah.
And so we get on the train. He will go up the steps to the second level and sit and stare at the person if there's a person sitting in that first seat, because that's where we always sit. And then we'll go to sleep mm-hmm. while we take a train for an hour to Baltimore.
Mm-hmm. Does he sleep on the floor?
Yeah. Yeah. He lays on the floor. And I mean, you know, as I said, most of the time, if he's not, if the harness isn't in my hand and he's not, you know, playing with something, he's asleep.
As he's presumably doing right now. I can't quite see him.
He's probably asleep. He almost certainly, you know, we're in a room, we're two guys talking, you know, there's nothing interesting for him. So, you know.
So, I mean, that is interesting, though, in terms of thinking about him as an animal with a job, which is that he also does have downtime of a sort. He knows when he's not on the clock mm-hmm. And knows what to do, which is do what a dog does, which is sleep, I guess.
So in my old office in Baltimore, I had a bed and an office, mm-hmm. you know, my own office. And we go, and when I got there in the morning, he would go and I'd take his harness off and he would go curl up on his bed and go to sleep. Mm-hmm. Now, if I left my individual office to go, say, you know, talk to a coworker, because it's an office that I, you know, worked in every day, I didn't need to reharness him and have him guide me around the office. I would just mm-hmm. walk around the office and, you know, move slowly so I didn't bump into people. Mm-hmm. If I didn't close the door, he would come try to find me after about 2 minutes.
Huh.
So if I'm not around him for about 2 minutes and the door isn't shut, indicating that I really mean it, I want him to stay, mm-hmm. you know, then he figures he should come find me.
He's very focused on checking in on you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, there are a handful of people who he sort of is focused on where they are. Me, you know, my wife, occasionally he'll sort of, you know, bond with someone else in the office. But, mm-hmm. you know, that's one of those things you try to avoid because you don't want him bonding with multiple people. Because if I'm walking down the street, on the one hand, I might want him to say hello to a person that I know. Mm-hmm. On the other, you know, I might want him to just continue walking and ignore the other people. In mm-hmm. fact, that's mostly what I want him to do.
Yeah.
So.
I want to talk more about that as well in a minute, hopefully. But are there any points in a typical day like the one that you described where his schedule does diverge from your own? Is it just those moments when the door is closed, when you're off doing something in an environment you're comfortable in, that he's on his own?
No, about the only time that his schedule sort of – where his schedule dictates is – He's fed in the morning before we leave. There have been a couple of occasions where I've been in a hurry, and you know I start putting on my coat and I go to harness him, and I haven't fed him yet, and he will go over and paw at his. He's got a big food bin with the dishes on top. He'll paw at it like you forgot something.
He knows how to look after himself.
Yeah. He sort of he's on a relief. He's on a twice, occasionally three, usually twice a day relief schedule. Uh-huh. So usually,
when you say relief schedule, you mean pooping and such?
Pooping and peeing. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. They call it relief schedule.
That's a good euphemism.
So he eats and then he goes out. Now if I'm working from home, it's he eats and then I take him out and I, you know. Walk him to a relief area that's, you know, near my building, and then go back in. But on a day where we're going to the office, say, it would be I'd feed him. As we're walking to the train, if he really needs to go, then he'll take me to a relief area. But one of the things that – and this is sort of a one of those unique things about different dogs. I have some friends who have service dogs where you take them to a relief area and the command is get busy. Mm. And you tell them to get busy and they instantly just like turn around one turn and they go and they're gone. Cheech has been known to take 10 minutes.
Oh boy.
Yeah. So if I have a train to catch, you know, that doesn't work. So on the days where I would go to Baltimore, we would go to Baltimore and then he would, you know, there were a couple of relief areas on the way. It's about a kilometer and a half from the train station to my office, and we would just, you know, walk, and he would use one of the relief areas along the way.
But I mean, imagine that this is something that has to be very specific in the training of service animals, which is that presumably they have to, you know, if you're going to, I would guess, be picking up his leavings, then he needs to do it in a way that where that's feasible for you. Is that?
Well, right. It depends. So some people have dogs where if they're in the middle of pooping, you can put your hand on their back and follow their back down to, you know, the ground, mm-hmm. and therefore figure out where the poop is to find it. Cheech, because he takes so long to go, and if I then try to touch him, he will stop going and look for a different spot. Uh-huh. What I instead do is take him to areas where the foot traffic should be as close to zero as possible.
All right.
So behind a fence, yeah. You know, sometimes in like a planter where there's like a fence around the planter, you know, uh-huh. a place where I am not expecting a person, especially like a kid, to be playing, an island
stepping
in the middle
freely.
Of the street. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it sort of depends on the dog. I've had, you know, sort of one dog that I was able to pick up after who didn't sort of freak out when you touched them when they were going. Mm. So, you know, like I said, it depends on the dog.
Yeah. That's really interesting. And, you know, we've already talked a little bit about other elements of his training, but does he ever have to learn new skills or re-up the ones that he already had? Or is that just an ongoing process of your relationship?
So because I use him every day – so some people – I know some people who have service dogs who sort of interchange using a guide dog and a white cane. Mm-hmm. I use a white cane very infrequently. Mm-hmm. I take him pretty much everywhere. I take him to the grocery store. You know, he guides me. We went to Broadway. Mm-hmm. You know, there wasn't a whole lot of room, but he crawled under the seat in a cramped little theater and went to sleep. Mm-hmm. So it's less of an issue for him. Mm-hmm. And in the event that he seemed to be slipping on a particular skill, then I would there are obedience drills that mm-hmm. you can do with the dog. Mm-hmm. That frankly, the German Shepherds like doing them a lot more than the Labs do. The German Shepherds love doing obedience drills. It's like the greatest thing. Cheech, not so much. She's like, why are we doing this? Like, yeah. We're just sitting here. Are you sure you don't want to play tug of war? Tug of war would be much more fun because you're clearly not actually going anywhere. I'm not actually working now. He's a very fun-loving dog.
Yeah, sounds like. How much of his time on a typical day does get to be committed to that kind of fun play enjoyment of just being a goofy dog?
I mean, frankly, most of his day, right?
Okay.
Because, I mean, I'm you know, I have a desk job.
Yeah.
So, you know, he's working when he's guiding me to and from work mm-hmm. or, you know, to and from someplace from my house or the office. So, for example, if I go to the grocery store, right, he's got to guide me onto the metro, from the metro to the grocery store and then, you know, to some extent around the grocery store. But, you know, most of the time, you know, if you sort of think about all the time when you're not moving around in a place that you're not familiar with, that's where he's got to work. And the rest of the time, he's down. Now, that's different from sort of playtime. Mm-hmm. You know, his playtime, I would say, probably more like a half an hour a day where, mm-hmm. you know, I'll play tug of war with him usually after dinner. Mm-hmm. You know, I finish up dinner, he will go and bring me a toy.
Yeah, like, just after your dinner, since he only eats in the morning.
Exactly.
Right?
After my dinner, yeah. He'll say, you know, okay, you know, he can tell sort of I'll sit back at the table and all of a sudden it's like I will feel, you know, a chin on my leg and I'll like, you know, like, yes, hello. And then he'll run over and go get a toy. Like, okay, you noticed me. Uh-huh. Now come, you know, play tug of war or fetch or what have you.
Yeah. This is probably a particularly for him, for his purposes, a great side effect of the kind of communication he has with you. Is that he knows how to get your attention.
And I mean, I mentioned that sometimes, you know, sometimes he needs to go out three times a day. Like, you know, if we had a really long walk, if he drank a lot of water, whatever, for whatever reason. If he needs to go out, he will go over to I keep his leash and harness sort of hanging on a sort of coat and hat rack by the door, and he will just go over and bat them, you know. And if I have headphones on because I'm working, you know, he'll bat them louder. Occasionally come over to me, knows me, and then go over and bat them again. So he's pretty persistent when he needs to be.
Yeah. His harness is also quite stylish, by the way.
Oh.
It's like a nice leather-based handle, it looks like, or leather-wrapped handle. Does he – so he doesn't wear that all, like at home, but
no.
but when he's out and about.
So so the harness is leather, and it's sort of a leather harness that goes over his shoulders, around under his chest, and sort of has a crossbar of leather that goes in front of his chest, so it's sort of, you know, around his legs, and then there is a U-shaped handle that is made of leather-covered metal, so it is a stiff handle with some padding in the, you know, in the base of the U that is where I hold on to. And that way, because it's rigid, the handle is rigid, if he turns one way or the other, I can feel the motion in my hand. Or even if he is taking a step up or down, I can feel the handle twist in my hand, so I know, okay, we've come up on a step, you know, et cetera.
Yeah.
When we are at home, or when we are in a place where I am going to be for, you know, hours, office, et cetera, then I'll take the harness off. Hotel room, for example, take the harness off. But, you know, here, even though, you know, I was going to be here for, you know, half hour to an hour, he's comfortable just laying down and going to sleep in the harness.
This podcast is sponsored by Ramp. Are you the decision maker in your company? Consider this. For the first time in decades, there's a better option for a corporate card and spend management platform. Meet Ramp, the only corporate card and spend management system designed to help you spend less money so you can make more. Most corporate credit cards offer points as incentives, but those points amount to less than they're worth in real cash value. Ramp's business cards offer you cash back, real money in your pocket. Plus, you control who spends what with each vendor. And Ramp's software collects and verifies receipts automatically, which means you'll stop wasteful spending and close your books in hours instead of days. Businesses that use Ramp add up to 5% to their bottom line the first year. If you're a decision maker, adding Ramp could be one of the best decisions you've ever made. And now get $250 when you join Ramp for free. Just go to ramp.com/easy. ramp.com/easy. ramp.com/easy.
Cards issued by Sutton Bank and Celtic Bank, members of FDIC. Terms and conditions apply.
We talked a lot about, you know, a kind of routine day that he is familiar with, where the two of you are going through a series of motions that you go through every day, getting to the metro, getting to Baltimore, getting to your office, and then everything that comes after. But what about days when things are less routine, where you're traveling somewhere else or something like this? Do you have to communicate with him differently so that he'll figure out what he has to do for you, how he has to help you out, how he has to do his job?
So the answer to that is that that's part of the – it takes 6 months to a year because at this point he is comfortable that I know what I'm doing and he can trust me in an environment that he's not familiar with to tell him where to go and that we'll be okay. And the flip side of that is that if we're in an environment that he knows really well and I make a mistake, then, you know, he'll let me know, as I mentioned with the, you know, the metro entrance here. But in a new environment where, you know, he's never been there before, now that we are, you know, a well-oiled machine, he's like, okay, this is a new airport. All right, where are we going, boss? And, you know, it's my job to figure that out. Now, when we get off the plane in an unfamiliar airport, I don't know where we're going either. So I will have to, you know, ask someone, excuse me, which way is baggage claim? But, you know, once I get pointed in the right direction, I say, okay, good boy, find right. And, you know, he'll start going right. And generally, they're also the dogs are also smart in that they can tell that they're sort of moving along with the flow of traffic. So everyone from the plane is going toward baggage claim. So we can probably follow along with everybody and that'll be okay. Occasionally that gets messed up because there's like a turn and there's enough of a flow of traffic that he'll miss the turn if I don't tell him. And so, you know, I have to sort of check in with people around me. It's like, you know, am I still heading toward baggage claim? Yeah, there's an escalator coming up. Okay, good boy. Cheech, find downstairs. And then, you know, he'll find the escalator.
Well, I mean, this also, this question of how you guys move through crowds together gets at a question I have, which is, as he's doing his job, what sort of interactions does he have with other humans? I mean, you said that sometimes he'll look at people who are looking at him, try to figure out what they want or whether he needs to interact with them. But, I mean, most of us have been, I think, taught not to interact with other people's service animals, which is probably
most people.
But I mean, probably not everyone follows those rules.
Like, that's true.
How does he behave when someone interrupts the job that he's doing for and with you?
If a person ignores the rule and, you know, seeks to say hi to him, he will say hi back. He is a very, very friendly dog. I think it's part of just the lab. German Shepherds, not so much. German Shepherds, if a stranger came up and wanted to say hi to the dog, you know, my two German Shepherds would both sort of sit and lean against me and sort of look up like, who is this person and why are the dog? And go, Cheech will, you know, wag his tail and go over and say hi if somebody calls him over. Now he will not do that as he is less likely to do that if he is actively guiding. Fortunately, it is unusual for somebody to try to distract him when I am when he's actually guiding me, like walking down the street. But you know, it happens on like a subway platform or in a subway car where, you know, he's the harness isn't in my hand, so he's kind of on deck, sort of in his head, he's on deck. So you know, he'll say hi. And I will have to ask the person, please don't talk to him.
That must be not the best part of your day.
Yeah, not so much.
What about other dogs or animals? Does he interact with other creatures?
It's a similar sort of situation with other dogs. He is more likely to go over to say hi to another dog. But again, it depends whether the other dog is ignoring him. So if I'm, you know, every summer I go to the National Convention of the National Federation of the Blind. It's like 3,000 blind people.
A lot of dogs there.
And, you know, sometimes he's fine because the other dogs are ignoring him and so he ignores them. But if the other dog sort of looks over and wags its tail, then he's like, hey, you're wagging your tail. We should say hi. You have a job too? Cool. We have the same job. So
this may be a difficult question to answer, but do you get the sense that Cheech enjoys his job? Is this
– In fact, so Cheech, you know, you haven't seen sort of Cheech very excited.
He's been pretty chill since he got to the office here.
He is an extremely waggy-tailed dog. I mean, he wags his tail a lot. And so one of the ways I know he enjoys his job is because, for example, you know, we're going to work in the morning. You know, we get into the metro and we get on the escalator and his tail is just going a mile a minute. And I'll say, good boy. And his tail will go even faster. And like his tail is smacking me on the leg. He's so excited. And especially when he figures something out. So for an example, when we were coming up here at the metro, when initially he was, you know, not sure that I knew what I knew where we were because I did not go to the elevator, the escalator that we typically go to. You know, he was understandably cautious. But then once he figured out that, no, I knew where we were going and he started to go toward the correct escalator, I told him, good boy.
tail's going a mile a minute. Mm. He's like, oh, yeah, I'm awesome. I am finding the way. And once we get on the escalator, he's like, good boy. Yeah. Who's a good boy? And, you know, he's just like, I am. Yeah. I'm awesome. So, yeah, he loves his job.
Yeah. Okay, so here's the question I've been dreading asking. You've had three previous service dogs. I guess they do have to retire at some point. What is the point at which you have to part ways with an animal that you have this intimate relationship with?
Well, so there's it's a complicated answer. You need to retire the dog before it figures out that it's not doing as good a job as it used to. And that is because it will stress the dog out to know that it is putting its human in danger.
Yeah.
Now, that said, my experience with this was entirely with German Shepherds. And the German Shepherds have a very different sort of work ethic than certainly than Cheech. And my understanding from talking to other service dog handlers is that, you know, it's a breed difference. I anticipate that, you know, Cheech will be happy to guide so long as I'm continuing to praise him, even if he is, you know, not doing as you know, bang up a job as he used to.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, he is at the age of, you know, five and a half, still acting mostly like a puppy when he's, you know, off leash.
Yeah.
So I am anticipating a long and fruitful relationship. But realistically, working life of a service dog is approximately 9 years at the outside, maybe 10 if you're lucky.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you retire them so that they don't stress out over the fact that they're not doing a good job.
Are there retirement communities for service dogs, or where do they – what happens to them?
There are. You know, most – you as the handler always have the option of keeping the dog as a pet. If that is not an option because of, you know, your housing situation, because, you know, once a service dog retires, it's not a service dog anymore. It's a pet. And so if you live someplace where you can't have a pet – you can have a service dog because of the law, but not a pet.
Right.
Then, you know, there are people who will adopt retired service dogs because basically they, you know, they get a dog for a couple of years who is going to be an extremely well-behaved, loving, and well-trained dog, right? In my case, my first dog, I kept until about a month before he passed away. That last month, he could no longer walk up and down the stairs in the building I lived in. So he moved out to, as you say, sort of a retirement home for dogs. There was a vet living in Western Mass who, you know, adopted older animals that were having difficulty. And so, you know, he went out there and I got a phone call saying, you know, his name was Levi. I got a call. Levi fell. He hurt his back. You know, he's not in any pain, but, you know, we're going to have to, you know, put him to sleep sometime in the next, you know, day or two. Can you get out here? And I was like, yep. So I went out there and was with him. So
it's, I mean, it's always awful to say goodbye to a pet, of course, but I imagine it must be even more acutely so when you have this kind of intimately professional relationship with an animal.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, it's really hard. In fact, I think – I don't remember if you mentioned in the podcast with Magic, the miniature horse that some people use the horses as guide horses. And there are a lot of reasons why that is difficult. You know, as the horse needs lots of land, the horse, you know, needs to either wear shoes or get used to walking on – terrain that is not sort of typical terrain that horses would be on. But some people choose to do it because the horses live for 30 years. And so you, you know, we're talking about probably needing one or at most two in the typical lifetime of a, you know, person using service animals. Whereas, you know, with a dog, it's about every, you need a new dog about every 7 to 10 years. So
that's, well, maybe this is a question that's related to that, but what's it like you know, we can talk a little – we have talked a little about Cheech's relationship to his job. But what's like for you having this animal in your life from moment to moment with whom you have this really specific bond? How does that feel?
It's like having – so you get to a point where especially when you get to that well-oiled machine state, mm-hmm. you get to a point where you feel like the dog is an extension of your left arm. Mm-hmm. You know, it's you get to a point where the dog feels almost like a part of you, mm-hmm. right? I mean, because you know, I tell people it's one of the fringe benefits of being a blind person is mm-hmm. I get to take a dog everywhere. Mm-hmm. You know, now. If you're not a dog person, this may not be the best thing in the world. If you are a dog person like me, this is like the greatest thing in the world.
Yeah.
And from his perspective, right, this is the greatest thing in the world. He gets to be with his human all the time. Uh-huh. You know, he gets to go to the office. He gets to go to restaurants. He gets to go on planes. He gets to go to other countries, you know, to hotels, on hikes. You name it, he gets to go. And from his perspective, it's a great thing. Mm-hmm. That said, you know, that means that when you have to retire them, it's hard on both of you. Mm-hmm. You know, when I retired my first dog, I basically went to the company I was working with. I was doing software programming at the time. And I said to them, I said, I need a bigger office. And they said, why do you need a bigger office? I said, because I got to bring two dogs to work now. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was fortunate to be in a position where – you know, I was important enough to the company that they were like, well, okay, I guess we can give you a bigger office and you can continue to bring your retired dog and your new guy dog to work every day. But, you know, I couldn't see myself leaving him home all day,
yeah.
you know, when that wasn't an option. Now, my second dog, I retired and I sent him to live with my parents because my dad also worked from home. Mm-hmm. And so it was great because my dad's dog had recently passed away. Mm-hmm. So it sort of worked out, right? Yeah. My dad had a dog and I knew that he was going to be with somebody. I know. You're bored. I'm sorry.
Is he stirring over there?
Yeah. He's heard us talk, you know, when he hears his name and me issuing commands, he's yeah. sort of like,
oh, interesting.
You're not holding the harness.
Yeah.
And you're just talking to Jacob, but you're saying my name and commands. Do I need to be paying attention? So.
Well, thank you so much for joining us to talk about Cheech today. This was so delightful.
My pleasure.
It's great. Thanks for listening to this episode of Working. I'm Jacob Brogan. This week, we want to recommend that you check out the XX Gabfest. The XX Gabfest is a biweekly podcast about feminism, gender, sexuality, health, politics, Beyonce, and other issues of interest to women and their friends. It's hosted by Invisibilia co-host Hannah Rosen, New York Magazine's Noreen Malone, and managing producer of Slate Podcasts, June Thomas, who is literally one of my favorite people in the whole world. Every other Thursday, get a heaping handful of feminist discourse about news and culture in your podcast feed in the XX Gabfest. Here at Working, we always also love to get emails from you, to hear from you. You can email us at working@slate.com. This episode happened because Al Elia emailed us at that address, said, hey, I am a Working listener, and I work with this great animal that has a job, and you might want to talk about him. We did, and we're so grateful to Al for emailing us. If you have suggestions for us, hit us up. We're happy to hear from you. This episode was produced and edited by the great Benjamin Frisch.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy.
Chumba. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumba. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hi, this is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, May the 14th. My colleague, Mark Joseph Stern, and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice, all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets.